billions of people just living out their lives, oblivious.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
There's something wrong. There's something wrong.
Don't know what it is.
Don't know what it's there.
Like a splinter.
Like a splinter.
Driving you mad.
Driving you mad.
Bring the ship up to broadcast depth. We're going in. Taking Neo to see her.
See who?
The Oracle.
Welcome aboard, everybody. We're happy you could join us for yet another round of what we hope to be insightful discussion. I'm James Sangster, founder of Houston Ghost Research. HGR is a spiritual crisis intervention and paranormal investigation group in the Houston area. I'm also the author of Help, I'm Haunted, Dealing with Ghosts through Amazon Kindle. We are also joined by Keith Davis, our co-host and partner in crime and fellow intellectual and seeker of truth. Today's show is going to center around Joe DeCat. He is a documentary film director on a quest for the truth. His recent film entitled All the Gold You Can Eat, EAT, is available on his website, aptly named allthegoldyoucaneat.com. He also has an insightful blog that accompanies his continuing exploration into the film's subject that's available at allthegoldyoucaneat.com/blog. So, Joe, I know, by the way, kudos on your documentary. It's fantastic work, in my opinion, from a journalistic standpoint. Can you give our audience an idea of what your documentary is about in, 25 words or less?
No, I can't. next question. No. So it's, wow. I mean, it's obviously what everybody wants to know. I think the whole point is that it's a very difficult subject. So I guess the easiest way of trying to frame this is it's about a mineral or some kind of, let's say, bioactive ingredient that has been discovered, possibly rediscovered, that doesn't seem to be analyzable by modern chemistry techniques, but that seems to have some very profound effects on living organisms. And that somehow seems to be tied in with the old ancient practices of alchemy. So the film that I made, I know I'm way over 25 words now, sorry. The film I made is really, it's a personal journey of exploration to try and get to the bottom of this story that I'd heard about.
So you had just heard about this bioreactive substance, and you just decided you were going to go investigate what this was all about, and you filmed your...
Yeah, I mean, I fell down a rabbit hole, as they say. I stumbled across this when I was researching some... I was writing a movie script, I think, at the time, and I needed to research aspects of gold mining or gold extraction. And that's when I stumbled across this story on the internet of David Hudson, who was doing some gold extraction, and instead of getting gold out, he was getting this weird white powder that had some very strange properties. So as I looked into this more and started reading about it and starting reading about the crazy effects and properties that this stuff had, I just I got bewitched by it. Sat with me for a couple of years. I was out in South Africa, and then I had a little window of time when actually I didn't have any work on. So I thought I'd just go out to the States and see if I could just find some of the people that whose commentary I'd been reading about, and go and meet them, see if there was perhaps a documentary there. And so basically that was it. I just kind of started by accident. I had never intended to make a documentary of myself as the sort of the vehicle. I wanted to get a presenter in there and a producer and director, and it just so happened that I kind of took on all those roles, and it became this extraordinary journey that I went on myself.
So you put it all together after the fact then?
In what sense?
Well, you said you didn't go out with the intention of making a documentary. You were just going out together.
The first time it was a research trip. I bought a little camera. I bought a 5D, and I went to film some interviews. And I realized, the stories I was getting, the footage I was getting was actually good enough to put a documentary together, in the manner that I'd been sort of shooting this research. So I just kind of carried on, really, rather than going back and trying to sell the idea to a TV company or getting a big crew on board, which actually was lucky, because if I, you know, if I'd pitched this as an idea, first of all, the cost would increase and I wouldn't have been able to hold on. I wouldn't be able to carry on the journey for the 2 years that it took me to get those results that you see at the end of the film when Don Nance, you know, finally agrees to teach me how to make gold and, you know, takes me under his wing. And that was a lot of time to, I guess, nurture that relationship with him so he could understand what I was trying to do with the film. And, you know, he'd finally released this, I guess, this big secret. So, you know, if I'd done it another way, I don't think that would have happened.
So just to sort of set some groundwork, because we're going to talk about some stuff that's very far outside the box. You mentioned the A word. So can you give us...
Yeah, that's where I was going to go.
Yeah. Can you give us an idea of what you think your definition of what alchemy is? What the hell is that?
I mean, the way most people see it, and I think perhaps this is the you know, what it's been given to us in you know, our history lessons, is alchemy was the predecessor to chemistry. It was the baby that grew up into chemistry but didn't quite know what the world looked like. And I actually think that's sort of a naive principle. My sense is that what happened when, you know, people like Mendeleev started codifying the atoms and putting them into the periodic table, you know, we had a system of analysis that worked really neatly in a way that humans like to see it fit in there, you know, and that's a system that's very robust and it works. But with that came an assumption that there's no other way that atoms exist. There's no other way that elemental atoms can organize themselves. So everything else that didn't fit into that was sort of swept under the carpet and said, well, that's the stuff that the alchemists did that didn't really work, that they got wrong. So from this, I'm sort of beginning
blame it on the alchemists.
Sorry? Oh, yeah, blame it on the alchemists, exactly. They were crazy. They were all just, you know, after gold, or they were all just charlatans. They got it wrong. The chemists knew what they were doing. But I think what's happened is that, you know, that we now have this assumption that there's only one form which atoms can take. But it seems, you know, with this research that I've been doing, that actually, you know, there's, you know, the theory behind Ormus, which is what this film is around, is that it is recognized atoms that we know about, but in a slightly deformed state, so that they behave differently. And you can actually work with them in a different manner to the way that we're sort of used to working with chemistry. So, yeah, it's kind of my sense is that, you know, it's not really a separation between alchemy and chemistry. It's just another kind of it's a material science. But we've got so used to this really neat system of periodic table. This two-dimensional version of the periodic table, that, you know, anything else is just, well, that's, you know, we believe the stigma of the alchemist, and we people don't want to touch it.
So talking to the alchemist that you did in the film, the definition that I sort of got out of it, and I'm wondering if you would agree with that, is that alchemy is the original old school chemistry, where chemistry was born out of. That seems apparent. But it also seems like alchemy also recognizes a spiritual presence or a spiritual consciousness in addition to just what we consider the hard science. Would you say that's a true statement?
Yeah, I would say that's very true. That there's a recognition. And I think, you know, even, you know, the medieval alchemists and the people like Fermat, even Isaac Newton recognized that with this, there was a spiritual aspect to the study, that, you know, you can use the study and what you learn from that, but the deeper you go into it, the more you realize there's more out there that you need to consider philosophically. So, I mean, that's an aspect that I do very much respect about the alchemists, is that they consider philosophically what they're doing much more than, I guess, your common or garden material scientist. But there's also an element there which I find a bit frustrating, which is a sense of, I guess, superiority. And, you know, maybe this is where the secrecy comes from the alchemists that say that, you know, if you were to understand what we do materially speaking, until you have learnt what we know spiritually, you will misuse what we can teach you. And right. So you can't have it. And I think, you know, that assumption that everybody's going to immediately become greedy and want to make gold once they know how to do this is, I don't think that's giving enough faith in terms in humankind, really, and what people generally
No, I agree.
Yeah, it's, and I think people, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, if you know how to make gold, why don't you go and make gold now? And it's like, well, it's not a particularly interesting way to get rich or to make money. You know, I could have become a gold miner.
Pretty labor intensive too.
Exactly. You know, you lock yourself away in a room, you probably breathe in lots of nasty chemicals, and then you go to the bank. And what kind of an existence is that? And I don't think most people, given the opportunity, most people want to live an interesting life where they consider, you know, interesting questions and interact with the world and hopefully make the world a better place. I think that's the majority of humanity, given the opportunity, would do that. So I have a little bit of a truck with some of the kind of secrecy and latent superiority that I came across about this, about the idea that, you know, well, we'll tell you what Ormus can do as a powder, but we don't want to talk about the manipulation and turning it into gold, because that's dangerous and people will misuse that. And ultimately, you know, that's where the science comes. It's like, well, you've got to be open. Science is about repeatability and openness.
As some people can hide behind that too, if they don't really know, or anybody can say that. Oh, I'm not going to show you that. It's too dangerous. You know, I mean, there's got to be some of that going on too.
Oh my, absolutely, yeah. I mean, some of the people I interviewed were quite clearly, and it's like, well, you know, the alchemy side of things, we don't talk about that because of, you know, it's secret and spiritual, and, you know, but we all talk about the alchemy.
Exactly.
Yeah, what are you talking about? Do you shut up? So, you know, there's definitely that. There's the pseudoscience. There's the people who don't quite know what they're talking about, the people who haven't done any experimentation. They love the idea of associating themselves with this esoteric world. But in fact, they don't know what's going on. But then there are the people that do know what's going on, who I think could be a little bit less dogmatic as well.
You know, it's not just alchemy, though. In the entire occult world, which I'm pretty well versed in, you get that sort of smoke and mirrors, I know more than you do, you know, man behind the curtain sort of mentality in a lot of the occult circles. And I think most people would consider alchemy occult or hidden knowledge. So it's just, there's egos involved. And
yeah, I absolutely, totally agree. And actually, I think that permeates culture in general. You know, whatever it is, whether if you read the Daily Mail, you know, here it's a very sort of right-wing newspaper. They're always bitching and moaning about the state of the country in terms of immigrants. So the people that in that little group, you know, they seem to believe they have more knowledge than the rest of the world about the truth of immigration, let's say. And so, you know, they surround themselves with the people that they want to talk to. And I think that's just sort of human nature to create these little groups where you find agreeance with other people. Right. And then everybody else doesn't quite get what you're talking about. They're all idiots. They're wrong. And that's one of the things that I find really interesting that I want to present, you know, why I find alchemy is such an interesting wedge to sort of to drive into the scientific community, because there's such a reaction to it that it immediately brings out that dogmatic side of the scientist game. Well, we know it's not true.
Yeah.
But, you know, where does that knowledge come from? That's actually, it's just theories. So it's kind of like, you know, it's holding up a mirror to those people that do surround themselves or hide away in their own little groups.
It really is. It's almost like religion has its own, or science has its own religious dogmatic following that they're hanging on to. And if you exist outside of that paradigm, or if you exist in something that science has already predetermined as, that's crap, then they don't want to hear it, even if it's something legitimate.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's, you know, people get very attached to models that, you know, that are easily explainable, that can be taught at school, and that becomes a paradigm and then a consensus, and then it becomes fact, and then everything else is, you know, thrown away. And, you know, I think that's the case now very much with the sort of the billiard ball theory of atoms, you know, the mechanistic idea of existence. It seems to be an accepted fact that, you know, we are just atoms and we are just machines that work in a sort of way that has this, that gives the impression of consciousness and life. But so, you know, there's just, it's like, well, actually, you know, there's been a philosophical debate about that since the Greeks, you know, where, if that's the case, how do you fit the soul into that mechanistic body?
Yep,
and so,
right.
You know, science has taken a sort of mainstream route into that or around that, and everything else, you know, you have to battle for your place to be not considered a kook. And I find that very frustrating, actually, yeah.
I love the fact that in your blog, and we're going to put a link to the website for the documentary and the blog and everything in the show notes, but in your blog, you specifically talk about challenging and keeping an open mind those preconceived notions. And I think that's really important for both sides of the fence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to be aware myself, and I think I mentioned this in the blog, which I've only just started putting together, so it's very ropey and there's only a few little bits in there and it needs tidying up. But yes, definitely do put a link in. That's very kind. I have now, and I've got to respect that I have now got to be aware that I made this film, put a lot of money into it. I've now got a vested interest, really, in proving the case for alchemy.
Right.
So I've got to be very careful of how I handle any information that I get, you know, and not become dogmatic in some way in exactly the way that I'm trying to, you know, tell people that they mustn't be. And I've got to be, you know, constantly aware of that fact that, you know, I could easily slip into what I'm trying to fight against. So I was going to say something else, but I forgot what it was.
You were talking about earlier, you were talking about preconceived notions. When you hear the word alchemy or alchemist, do you think that from what you've seen, is it generally a negative or a positive connotation to that term? Or what have you seen?
To be honest, I wouldn't say there's many people out there that even know that there are alchemists that exist today.
I see.
And, you know, anyone who then stands up and calls themselves an alchemist, I have a bit of a problem with that, because it's like, well, how does that make you different to an ordinary scientist? And I guess it's that idea, you know, that we talked about earlier, that there is this spiritual dimension to the work they do. But, you know, most scientists actually have, biologists or whatever they have their spiritual beliefs and they have their philosophical understandings of the work they do. That doesn't, you know, it doesn't just because the alchemists have thought about their philosophy doesn't mark them out as different. So I do have a bit of a... I don't like the word alchemist, I have to say. So anyone who calls themselves an alchemist, I think, you know, by the very nature of using that word, is kind of marking themselves out, holding up a little bit of a red flag and saying I'm different. And so, you know, if you want someone to take what you're doing seriously, I think you need to learn how to play the rules a little bit, play the game, you know, learn the rules and work within the mainstream systems. So, you know, most people, as I said, when I talk about this, most people don't even know that there's people out there, you know, actually claiming to be alchemists.
Well, you know, I didn't. I had heard the term before, but I thought it was something long gone, you know?
Right. You know, and perhaps it is something that should have been long gone because, you know, maybe in those days they didn't really know, you know, alchemy wasn't a very grown-up science, perhaps. I don't really know. I'm not enough of a scientist to actually know what alchemists were really doing. So, you know, I use the word slightly derisively. Is that how you say it, derisively? When I, you know, talk about alchemists, and I think I've written a blog. Well, one of my blog is actually, it's called Irritating Alchemists. So it's specifically about that idea that they are somehow different and possibly, you know, consider themselves superior to ordinary scientists.
Yeah, it's that all comes down to ego, I think, man.
Absolutely, it's that age old thing of you know how you consider yourself, you know, superior. The ego loves to have knowledge that other people don't have. You know, it's that thing of like, oh well, I knew that already. You know, even before you told me.
Yeah, it's like, oh, and I was the first one to know that.
Yeah, actually, so you know, I'm a bit better than you. And it's right. That sense that people hang on to that still. It's really find it difficult to let go of that ego side of discovery, of knowledge. And I think, you know, there's that, you know, those people that sort of call themselves alchemists, they want to be seen as special. It's like, well, we know something that you don't. And not only that, we're not even going to tell you what it is. So, you know, tough shit.
I think they call that a priesthood in some circles.
Right. Yeah, there you go. It's that idea that, you know, you got to, if you want to get whatever it is that they have, you got to go through them. And it's, you know, it's holding power. Absolutely.
That reminds me of that Carlin joke, which is like Air Marshal Carlin. People invent these terms and then, you know, they make up these characters that go along with these terms and they create their own thing, like you're talking about there with the alchemist. It's like, oh, well, I'm an alchemist. Now they have a term to attach to their behaviors.
Right. So. Yeah. People, so, we love to do that, don't we? We love to surround ourselves in families that do and believe the same things that we do and believe.
And in the same vein of alchemy, I'm leading us to where we need to go here. And this may be a loaded question for you, Joe, because you're not really an alchemy expert. You're just sort of discovering what this stuff is from the sound of it. What in your opinion, is do the alchemists think a philosopher's stone is? Because that's central to the alchemy mythology.
Yeah. Okay, so in 25 words, the ultimate prize of the alchemists. You know, they were looking for this substance that would, you know, you could project it into say molten lead, and it would convert the lead into gold. It would change the atomic structure, convert it into gold. They obviously didn't know it was atomic structure that changed it. But also that same substance would have healing properties. It was an elixir of life, keep you young looking, you know, cure all illnesses. And then there's the idea that it would lead to your spiritual enlightenment somehow. So the Philosopher's Stone was this kind of all-encompassing, very useful thing that they could make up, which would obviously give them wealth and eternal life. So that's the theory behind it.
So the thought process of some of the alchemists that you talked to in the film was that this substance that the film revolves around called Ormus may be the Philosopher's Stone. Is that correct?
Well, I think what happened when Hudson first started doing his research on this and started giving lectures, he found what he did is he found a lot of old biblical texts and ancient Egyptian texts and even the sort of the writings of the Egyptian alchemists and the European alchemists that referred to a substance that sounded a lot like the stuff that he found. So he started saying, look, I've got this weird stuff that behaves really strangely, that when I try and have it analyzed, it doesn't seem to analyze in any way that, you know, we can see what it is. But if you look at it like this, through this lens of these texts, it seems to be the same stuff that all these people are talking about. So he made the assumption that you could eat it and it'd be good for you. But he leapt into this sort of very quickly, this realm of saying that it is the Philosopher's Stone. It will give you spiritual enlightenment. I don't know if the Philosopher's Stone exists or not. I've seen videos online of some crazy guy out in Russia who seems to be making the Philosopher's Stone. You can see him do the whole process and drop something in a little wax pellet into a pot of boiling lead, and it seems to come out as gold. I don't necessarily see why that is impossible. You know, the atomic restructuring, you know, the process I went through with Don Nance at the end of the film seems to create gold from where there wasn't gold. So my assumption from my own experimentation is that there is atomic theory that we don't understand that seems to work in a way that doesn't fit in with the billiard ball theory of, you know, of elements that, you know, maintain their shape unless they're smashed to pieces with another very fast moving atom or subjected to intense heat and radiation. So given that I already believe there's an element of possibility there, it's not a massive leap for me to believe that actually, you know, given certain kind of cookery kitchen techniques, you couldn't make something up that will affect the atomic structure of another element. What I have difficulty with is the whole sort of the idea that anything in a pill form or anything that you can eat is going to in any way create spiritual enlightenment. It might create health. It might be a mineral that our body is lacking given our sort of existent agricultural methods. But I have a problem with that idea of spiritual enlightenment.
So hold on just a second, Keith. This gets into some of the other research we've done and some of the other guests we've talked to. I agree with you completely in that you have to be highly suspicious of anything that anything you eat or medicine or, you know, some sort of potential fakery that supposedly creates spiritual enlightenment. But I do wonder if there is some interaction between this stuff and the pineal gland in the brain, which is closely associated with spiritual growth and perception on a spiritual level. I wonder if this stuff is not interacting with your pineal gland. And if it does, that certainly could be an effect of what we would consider in colloquial terms, spiritual growth. You guys talk about that at all?
I didn't specifically talk about anything, you know, certainly not about the pineal gland. That's something I don't know about. So, I mean, in terms of how it might act specifically on the body in a spiritual or mental way, I don't know. There's lots of sort of vague theories. Something that I've been thinking about recently is that given that we sort of pretty much accept now in terms of physics, in terms of kind of physics where you get into the subatomic particles, what's it called?
Quantum physics.
Physics. Yeah. Given that we now sort of accept, you know, that quantum physics, when you get into the constituent parts of atoms, it's not really point. There's nothing really that's a point or a solid lump of matter. It is all just it's energy that's behaving in certain waveforms. A wave cannot exist without a time constraint on it. You know, a wave is an action over a period of time.
Yeah, it's motion through time. Absolutely,
it's motion through time. There you go. So, given that we sort of now generally accept that at the atomic level, there's no sort of fundamental particle that you can take out from time. You know, it's like saying, you know, I want to catch a wave from the sea. If you put a bucket of water and try to take that wave out that you saw there, all you're left with is a bucket of water. You don't have a wave anymore.
Right.
So, you know, if we think that there's a time element to all matter, and that we're talking about now an element that somehow behaves differently, that somehow has these, you know, is perhaps more closely associated to that aspect of it, you know, perhaps it works more in that sort of zero point realm, perhaps, than the more solid atoms that we can physically see that make up matter. Gotcha. That's one of the theories that Ormus is, you know, it hasn't quite fully evolved from the zero point, let's say. And it behaves in that way, you know, it behaves slightly more in that wavy, esoteric sort of form. There is a possibility that, you know, eating this kind of stuff will allow the vibrations in your body, or the kind of general, I don't know, the general creation, the general atmosphere of your body to work in a more energetically coherent way. And let's say that that's the case, that, you know, that your mind now becomes a little bit more energetically coherent, you tap a little bit more into the sort of that energy flow, then yes, you know, what we see as paranormal activities, you know, remote viewing or poltergeist activity, or being able to know what's going to happen on the back face of a card before it's flipped over, whatever, suddenly you've got a potential method or a potential theory to explain that kind of stuff. So I do have a little bit of a belief here that, you know, this stuff could actually be acting in that realm, and possibly could help your body work in a way that it is a little bit more connected to, I don't know, whatever it is, the zero point energy, dark matter, whatever, that energetic connection that we have with the rest of the universe. But again, I don't think that is going to help you become more spiritual. I think it will help you understand what is out there, the concept of reality a bit better, from which you can then infer your philosophies. You can then decide, you have more information to decide how to be a better person. But that work, that spiritual work, you know, that morality, that comes from discussions, from working within society, from learning about what you're doing, from it's an active process that you have to take on yourself. It's not going to come from a pill.
Yeah, that's like a byproduct of it, you know. There was a specific scene I was curious about. It was kind of implied that Nance held up this this little container, and it had a few little obvious chunks of gold in it. Did he claim to have created those himself? Because he never showed them again.
That was the first time that I actually got to film him. It was quite bizarre. I'd flown out to Florida entirely to try and find Don Nance and to get to film. I'd never met him before, and he said come over. So there I was, and he just wasn't around. He didn't come to the meeting, and apparently he was ill. I went to his house and just left a note on his door, and he wasn't there. I was like, shit, man, I got to fly back to LA now, and that was a waste of effort. So I was driving back. I was about to head off to the airport, put some petrol in the car before giving it back. And there he was in the petrol station buying some bottled water.
Oh, like, wow.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. I mean, that was kind of bizarre, actually. So I managed to find him. And, I went back to his house at that point. And that's when I got an hour of him on tape. And he showed me those little nuggets of gold. Now, that's absolutely what he claims he made. in the film, I think you see a moment when he goes and digs in a bucket or a sort of glass container in the back of his garage and says, this is what I cooked up on a mountain 5 years ago. So yes, he used the same process that we went through, cooked up a bunch of ormus, went through the process that he shows in the film. And that's the black bucket of crap that he's got in his garage. And what he does every sort of 2 or 3 years, he'll have that assayed for mineral content, for gold, silver, you know, for a string of, I think it's 37 or 47 elemental elements.
The same batch, he'll have assayed.
The same batch,
over and over again?
Little,
yeah. Yeah, because over time it gets more in it, correct?
Exactly. That's the really interesting thing, and that's where the theory that there's some kind of radiation that is being emitted comes from, because it's changing over time. A chemical reaction needs energy to activate it. Once you take away that energy, the chemical reaction tends to stop.
Yeah, showing more gold and silver over time, for according to the assays.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found the same thing myself. You know, when I took the experiment that we did, when I took that back, had it first assayed, there was very little. Then I had it done again, and there was more. And then I sort of did it again. And it's changing over time. So first of all, that gold he did, he took a certain amount of that black stuff he's got, you know, that black sand that he created, that black burnt mess, and treated it exactly like you would, you know, like a heap leach mining process. Dissolved all the way the stuff that wasn't gold, got the aqua regia, which is gold in the suspension of, I think, hydrochloric acid. Then I think what you do is, I don't know exactly how you do it, but you precipitate away somehow, or precipitate out the gold, or you clear out you remove the hydrochloric acid.
Yeah, there's a few ways to do it, I think, actually. Right. Yeah.
And then he was left with gold.
Right. You know, and a lot of people don't know, gold does not have to be gold. It can be black in color as well. That's one of the things he was saying in there. Until it's cleaned up, it doesn't necessarily look
right.
Gold.
Exactly, yeah. That's what he's saying. It's like, you know, you wouldn't, to look at this, he said, to look at this, it looks like a black, you know, a lump of black mess. Until you clean it up, until you treat it in the way that our gold miners treat it and then put it in bullion. You know, it isn't gold in the sense that, you know, it's not a gold coin, but it is gold. So yeah, those gold, that gold he made out of sea salt.
So we've sort of danced around this term a little bit. Let's go 5,000 words or less. What is ormus? That's the million-dollar question.
Okay, we did. Perhaps we should have talked about this a little bit at the beginning, because it's going to be confusing otherwise. So ormus seems to be this – it seems to be elements, and it seems to be elements from the platinum group of metals, which is sort of in the middle of the periodic table. Platinum, rubidium, rhodium, silver, gold, there's about 11 of them, I can't remember, my memory's not very good. Specifically these, it seems to be this group of metals that can exist in this deformed state that we talked about. So that if you take let's take gold. An atom of gold has a specific shape, and it has a specific form. I think it's, isn't it? It's number 81 or 81 in the periodic group, periodic table. So it's got 81 protons. I think it's 137 neutrons and 81 electrons that revolve around that and circulate it. So the outer shell has something like, I think it's 2 electrons on the outside. That's what we measure. We measure in our analytical techniques, we measure the effect of the outer shell of electrons, how they interact with other particles, and then the weight of that atomic weight. And that gives us the information that tells us that it's gold.
Okay.
Now, so what that does, you've got this atom, which in that format, if you take another gold atom, the electrons that revolve around it, they can join together, they can swap around and fly around both gold atoms. So you have these two atoms that are sharing electrons now. And that's what causes that strong electromagnetic bond. And you get another one in there. You get this lattice work of atoms that behave in a certain way structurally, create this lattice that gives us what looks like
metal.
Gold metal. Exactly.
Right. So at this point in the interview, unfortunately, we had a technical difficulty, and about 30 minutes worth of our conversation was corrupted, and we didn't have a backup, which we will now have in the future. So when we come back on in just a second and resume the conversation, we try to give a brief summary of what we're talking about and catch up with what was missed. But it's going to be a brief summation so that we can finish the rest of the discussion that we want to cover within a timely manner. So we'll jump back into our interview now. So it looks like we had some technical difficulties, and part of our interview was cut off. So I'm going to summarize part of it so we can continue to move forward a little bit. So this is what I remember us talking about based on in our notes. We talked a little bit about, we were in the middle of discussing Don Nance and his research and his methodology, and that it was a little dangerous for him, and there may have been some sort of radiation poisoning for him that you talked about specifically in the documentary. So that was covered in your documentary. We got a little bit into, and I think this is important to discuss, David Hudson's research and his claims that his scientific research that you talk about in the film is seems to be, at least on the surface, relatively clean or truthful as far as we can tell. But he's making some rather disparaging claims in terms of the spiritual connection, and he's made some interesting, I think, in my opinion, connections to biblical manna, both in Egyptian and culture and Egyptian mythology as the bread of life, to the Egyptian priesthood, and to what we know in our culture as biblical manna. And that connection seems logical based on some of the stuff we're seeing and the descriptions of the white powder being ormus and that it's made from gold or associated with gold. And he even made some in some of his lectures that you can find on YouTube by searching David Hudson lecture, he made some interesting comments to Zachariah Sitchin's work, which I'm relatively familiar with, and we've talked about some on the show. So we were about to get into some of the interesting stuff that is verified and some of the work that has been done with livestock and plants. We touched on that a little bit earlier. So,
No, I think one of the interesting things was, I think, you know, we were talking about Don Nance and the work that he did. One of the issues, I'm not sure if you got this bit or not, is that, you know, I'm not, I haven't released the methodology that he gave to me. Because first of all, you know, I promised to him, you know, one of the conditions that he would show me, you know, how to make the gold was that I wouldn't release it on the film. And he has his own personal reasons for holding back that information. He's quite attached to the idea that gold is, you know, the last refuge of the people to maintain their wealth away from fiat currencies that the governments make us use. So, you know, I have my own beliefs about that, but he, so, you know, that's one reason why, you know, that I don't want to release the information at this stage, because I gave him my word. But what I would like to do is to find a safe place to do this, you know, with some scientists to repeat the work. And the reason why I want to do it with scientists before I release all this information out onto the internet is that Don got really sick when he did the burns that he did. You know, that he holds up a little vial and shows that on the film, and this is some lumps of gold that he collected from that, you know, bucket of black mess that he's got in his garage. He got really sick from that. Now, you know, he said his hair fell out. He said he lost some teeth. He was knee crawling, you know, and he said if he hadn't been taken ormus after that, he would have probably been dead. So there's something that gets released from this process that is really toxic. It could be mercury poisoning, and there's a possibility that it's radiation. You know, it's quite a leap to get there. But, you know, if already you've made the inference that, you know, you can mess around with the atomic structure of elements, you know, in your kitchen, if you're changing the positions of the constituent parts of an atom, that's what radiation is. It's the energy that is released at that point. So it's not such a massive leap to think that, you know, if really that's what is actually possibly happening, that there is an energy that is released, some kind of radiation that is very damaging to health. Now, Don Nance holds up in the film this a cooking pot in which he was drying out, or just basically simmering, some of the stuff that he made. he had it on a low simmer, and said he came back to it and it had peeled. His words are that it had peeled that pot like an onion. You can see on the film it's covered in this white shit, and the edges of the pot have kind of peeled back. Now, even if you left a pot like that on a burner at 600 degrees for 2 or 3 hours, it's not going to do the kind of damage that you can see in this in the pot that he showed me.
Yeah, it's almost weird. It's almost like somebody took a shotgun to it, honestly, looking at it.
It's weird, isn't it? Or someone put the lid on really tight and then exploded a small bomb in it.
Right.
It's kind of like peeled back, weird. It's very, very strange structural damage to the metalwork. So that something did that. Something made Don really sick. And I don't want to go publicizing how to do this until we know actually what's going on. So, you know, my next step, I think this is what I was saying, is that what I'd love to do next is, you know, I want to conduct some growing experiments, you know, and do some time-lapse photography. But I also want to take this into a very safe and very methodological environment, you know, some kind of laboratory where we can measure what goes in, measure what comes out, you know, in terms of the constituent atomic elements, and have them assayed. And so it's very clear-cut methodology, you know, for the scientists to see, you know, that there is actually some atomic change going on. But also, and this is really important, to measure any kind of toxic effects that come from it. So, you know, have a radiation meter there. A Geiger counter. There you go. Have a Geiger counter there. Have a fume hood that can measure if there's, you know, any kind of gases coming off. And that's really important. I want to make sure that, you know, this isn't something really toxic before I do release the information. And this kind of ties back into this whole thing of, we were talking about earlier about, you know, alchemists being quite secretive about this. Maybe there's good reason. Personally, though, you know, in terms of the financial side of things, the idea that, you know, if everybody suddenly starts making gold, first of all, I don't think everybody's going to go out and start making gold. Second of all, my personal belief is that, you know, financial systems should somehow try and move away from this idea that what we create for money is a closed system of which we all have a chunk of and we can bargain within that chunk. So that actually, you know, wealth is your portion of the pot. And I think, you know, with the kind of algorithms that can be created, you know, by communication over the internet, you know, if somehow there can be an algorithm that, you know, the work that you do creates wealth at that level. So, you know, if you're a carpenter, you say you've done 5 hours of work, created this, somehow that creates an algorithm that is the work that you've done. Your money is created by your work rather than...
Yeah, and it's all based on value, actual value. Yeah,
exactly. It's based on value in the system. So it's not about, you know, what your value is judged from the pot that you have to sort of, you know, get your little percentage out of somehow on the market. Because the market, the idea that you've got a perfect market will judge things. We know that doesn't work. We know that the free market is biased and, you know, in so many ways. So, you know, also my thing about, you know, this, so basically in summary, I don't necessarily believe that even if everybody did become a gold maker, you know, that would, okay, so it might trash the market of gold, but we'd have more gold, which is quite a useful resource, you know, for electronics.
Right.
So I'm not so worried in terms of this sort of structural dangerous technology side of holding that information. But I do respect the fact that I promised Don I wouldn't repeat what he told me on the film. But he was also quite happy that, you know, within a scientific environment, you know, to move this information forward, it's perfectly legitimate. And he's quite happy with the idea of me doing something like that.
So just for the sake of clarity, and for the listeners, it is a very safe practice for the most part to make ormus from seawater or some of the other methods to make ormus itself, the monoatomic structure. But the dangerous process is taking that monoatomic structure and trying to somehow transmute it or collapse it down into the lattice metallic structure that we know as gold.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be the issue. That seems to be where the making ormus seems to be very easy. There's various ways you can do it. You can take gold. You can cook it with sodium, get sodium gold, I think, and then you boil that down in a lye solution, precipitate out a white powder. That is pure ormus gold, apparently. That's quite easy to do. You can also make ormus by precipitating by putting sodium hydroxide into seawater, literally seawater, or reconstituted seawater, which is literally sea salt with water in it. Drop in the 20% solution of sodium hydroxide, that'll create a precipitate, which you collect, you rinse, and then filter off and dry out. That is apparently, depending on the sea salt you use, that is almost rich material. That's the material that I took with Don, and one of the key factors to flip it back into its metallic state is that you've got to subject it to UV radiation. So I left it out in a baking tin literally for a couple of weeks. At that point, there doesn't seem to be any kind of release. It's when you take that and burn it, and we burnt it, you know, there's a couple of elements in the burning pot that's what I'm holding back, that one bit of information. Now, you can, if you want, you can go on the internet and you can find out what that element is. It's really, it's out there, you know, a little bit of digging around and you'll find it. It's at that point that it seems to release something really toxic. So that's the thing, that's the part of the experiment that, you know, A is interesting because it seems to be flipping it back into a precious metal that, you know, we find alluring. But also it seems to be the one part of the process that releases something toxic, whereas the rest of it seems to be very benign. Not only benign, but actually, you know, produces something that seems to be bioactively very, very beneficial.
So, you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just wanted to give some additional information on how to make Ormus. I actually now have this book. One of Don Nance's students wrote a book called Ormus, Modern Day Alchemy, a primer of...
Written by... he's in the film.
Dennis William Hack Emmons and...
Chris
Lewis
Emmons,
Johnson.
Yeah.
So I've actually got that book now because I did a little bit of research on this, and okay. It documents how to make Ormus. So if you really want from Don Nance's perspective, how to do that, this is his method, several methods actually that they document.
Absolutely. It's a great, I mean, if you're really interested in going out and doing it yourself, I mean, it is, you know, it's Don's method. There's all the different methodologies in there of how he does it. I don't think he's put Solomon's process in there, which is the one that he taught me.
Flipping it back.
I don't think that's the case. I mean, as I said, you can find that on the internet somewhere.
Well, you know, I think I know what you're talking about. And if it is what I think, I can understand why he wouldn't want that put out there. It makes perfect sense to me if it's what I think it is. But what I thought was interesting is he said it doesn't want to go back to gold. It's very hard to get it, you know, back to that state because it doesn't want to go back to that state of solid gold.
Yeah. And actually, almost more interestingly, really, this is something... You know, the alchemist, the irritating alchemist, will say it's more valuable in its alternate form. There's more you can do with it.
Absolutely,
you know, gold doesn't do anything. That's why we use it as money, because it doesn't do anything. It sits there and doesn't tarnish, and it's kind of pretty and shiny, but it doesn't really do anything. Okay, it conducts electricity, but in the Ormus state, it does so much apparently. So, you know, flipping it back to metal might be interesting. It might be a useful way, you know, in terms of, you know, rather than digging great big holes in some of the most beautiful parts of the planet and fucking them up with all the machinery to get a bit of gold out of the ground. Maybe there's a better way of getting the gold that we can put in our cell phone battery connections. So I should have gone down at the end of that sentence instead of up.
Well, it looks there like there's two different schools here. There's people that look at this from the point of, oh, we can make gold. Or there's the other people that look at this, which is the group I find myself in, that says, hey, I like this idea of this Ormus material. There seems to be some value in taking this. Let's go explore that area.
Absolutely. You know, but I think this is the slight irritation that I have with the people in the communities. They presume that if you teach people how to make gold, everybody's going to be interested in that. The only reason why I focused on the gold is because it's conceptually quite a simple thing to explain to people, and it's a hook to get people interested in the subject.
Yes.
And it's also experimentally quite simple to show there's something interesting going on. The real interest in this stuff, absolutely, like you say, is what it seems to do specifically for agriculture, and, you know, what the work that Arthur Ziegler is doing with, you know, his agricultural additives, you know, it just seems to be very profoundly useful to organisms. It seems to be a mineral that we're lacking at this point, and it seems to really help the, you know, humans or animals self-heal. And it seems to allow plants to be, you know, to express themselves in the sort of way that they genetically were, that they genetically are ideally
predisposed.
Predisposed to do, you know, without, you know, issues of nutrients lacking or diseases or whatever. So there's, I mean, the interest in it exactly is not in the gold state, but it's a really good way of getting people interested in it. And perhaps, you know, maybe there's, you know, useful ways of mining, new useful ways of mining minerals as well.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Some of the, from my own notes from your documentary, some of the stuff that was talked about was, and these are, the first ones are David Hudson's claims of, repairs, DNA damage. I'm not sure if there's any evidence on that, but he also made the claim that it's potentially, it's a cure-all, it's a panacea for curing all disease. That seems shenaniganish and suspicious, but there's also some science going on with Arthur, who you just mentioned, where they've done some controlled studies on livestock and plant growth. Can you talk about sort of the panacea and David Hudson's perspective versus what's been done with the science?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what David Hudson is tapping into when he says it's a universal medicine, and actually, you know, the communications that I had with him personally in email when I was making this film, he was very clear and said, this is not a medicine. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that. But what I think he meant by it is it's not that it's a medicine in the traditional way that we think of medicines, that they cure symptoms.
It doesn't fix a problem.
It doesn't fix a problem per se. What it allows the body to do is it allows the body to be in a much better position to heal itself. And recently, it's funny, there was a documentary actually on TV here in the UK just a week ago about what the placebo effect is. And I've always found this really interesting. Science has swept under the carpet the placebo effect, saying it's, you know, we know that this is there's remnants in all scientific studies where the body heals itself. So we know that that's what acupuncturists and spiritual healers and anybody who's an alternative medicine medicinal practitioner works with. But, you know, the question is, what is the placebo effect? That is the body healing itself. And I think that's really fascinating. And I think the idea of almost being a universal medicine is not that it's a universal medicine, but it's something, it's, I guess the easiest way I can imagine this is it's a mineral that we lack, that without it, we're sort of not particularly healthy. But with it, we are in a much stronger, better physical condition to be able to allow our body to heal the things that it can naturally heal itself anyway. So as a universal panacea, I think there is some credence to that, okay, because it seems to be a very potent, I guess, mineral or something that we don't have in our systems at the moment in enough supply that, you know, without that we get diseases.
Isn't it also very high in alkalinity? Or is it not? I wasn't clear about that. In the final stage.
I'm not sure. It's possible, you know, in so much as it takes our bodies out of that kind of acidic environment, almost like a sodium bicarbonate therapy.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If it's high in alkalinity, I can see why it would cure a lot of things, or it seemed to cure a lot of things, you know.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know about these things. This is, I mean, it's something that I sort of wanted to stay away from in the film because it's very difficult to measure the exact specific thing that is working on any one illness. You know,
yes,
certainly human beings, it's like, you know, well, I took this thing and I cured my cancer, but I also did a juice diet, for instance. It's like,
right,
you know, which one actually, you know, did the healing here? It's a very complex area.
It has to be a very controlled study, yeah.
Exactly. They're very expensive. You know, you've got to get it FDA approved or whatever, you know. So it's a very difficult area. What Arthur Ziegler did, you know, and with his product C-Crop, which I think is really interesting and makes perfect sense, is he most of the research he does with plants. You know, you don't need licenses to experiment on plants, but you can see very quick and very dramatic results. But he also did experimentations with livestock, you know, as a feedstock additive. Now, his product, C-Crop, is actually FDA approved, which is really interesting. You know, they've seen that it's A, it's non-toxic, B, it has, you know, beneficial effects. So by taking this out and looking at, you know, specific measurable results in large scale populations of livestock, I think that's a pretty clever way of measuring the effects, measuring, as Arthur says, the bioactive effects of almost. He also did another really interesting experiment. This is why I really respect Arthur. He's gone and done traditional science with this stuff. He did I don't know if you know what a four swim test is. It's where you take a mouse, and literally plop it in a beaker of water and watch it swim till it drowns. So you can measure the stamina of that animal. And then you have a control population, and then you have the population where you give them a substance and measure how long it takes them to drown. It's a pretty dark experiment.
Right. Sounds like.
Yeah, but it's, you know, scientifically, it's an established principle.
Right.
And it's a very clear-cut way of measuring stamina and how an ingredient will affect that stamina. And he did that with a, you know, I think he did it with 40 mice in the end. You know, so that you have so you can have statistically relevant results. And he said, you know, from his results were showing that the mice who had been fed a diet, exactly similar diets, but the ones that didn't receive any ormus, or rather the ones that did receive some ormus, swam for 3 times longer before they reached terminal exhaustion.
Wow. Yeah, that's
three
what it's called.
Three times longer. That's pretty extraordinary, isn't
over it? What, did they say over what period of time that they were given this ormus, that it took for them to reach that level of endurance?
I've no idea, actually. So that's probably, you could probably send him an email, find out. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe,
yeah, that would be interesting.
If you go to his website, C-Crop, I think it's just ccrop.com, there's a list of the experiments that he's done there. And it's I think it's under data or information or something. And I think he's written that one up. He might not have written up the drowning mice experiment. Cause it's,
right.
Joe, could you tell us what people are talking about when they refer to this this stuff as M-state?
M-state is just monatomic. I personally don't like the word ormus. Don't really know where that comes from. There's some biblical references to it. It's a sort of bastardization of Orm. Orm being the acronym that Hudson came up with, which was orbitally rearranged monatomic elements. And somehow that then... You know, I think ormus was
derived from that.
I think ormus possibly is the Hebrew for tree of life. I'm not sure, but you know, it's a biblical term as far as I can tell. I'm not keen on it. It's the word people use. M state is monoatomic state minerals. So it's actually much more scientific, and I prefer that. You know, I prefer referring to these as M state. And if I get into discussion. You know, it's a better terminology. So,
right. M-state elements is the same thing as essentially saying monoatomic elements.
Yeah, exactly. That's my understanding of it, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So Arthur did some really, he had some side-by-side comparisons that you showed in the film of before and after bean growth.
Runner bean. Was it runner beans? No, it was some kind of bean seeds. Which were really interesting. It was the seeds that he got from the seed company, and then the first generation of seeds that he got from the ones that he planted, which had been grown enormous, and they're almost twice the size.
Yeah, they're giant.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same that David Wolfe did a very similar experiment, or shows the same results with macuna beans. When I'm in Hawaii, he showed me that, and also, and it's not in the film, but I think it's in the accompanying videos.
Walnuts,
exactly. Well, there's walnuts, but there's also walnut seeds. Barry Carter goes digging around in his garden and pulls out seeds from an ormus tree and from a non-ormus tree, and it's the same thing. They're like 1.5 times bigger. So right. For some reason, you know, just cooking them, growing plants in ormus seems to make the seeds much bigger. And obviously the fruit, you know, then you see the pictures of the fruit that come out. Oh, excuse me. I should have knocked back that glass of wine so quickly. You see the pictures of fruit. So you see the pictures of fruit that come out, you know, from these trees. They're bigger. And in fact, I had a really interesting conversation with a guy who's his company produces drip feeding and drip watering products for agriculture. But he's recently got into ormus, and he's creating ormus from Vortrap spin, you know, from spring water here in the UK, and creating and selling a product for people. What he found fascinating, not only, you know, he did some tests with tomato plants. Not only do they grow better, quicker, and, you know, they taste sweeter, but they're almost impervious to illness. You know, he tried to freeze them. He hit them with bugs and stuff, and they just withstood all these tests and wouldn't die. So, you know, the plants are much hardier, which is interesting because it's the same as what Arthur Ziegler found with his test on broiler chicks in Holland. I think it was a quarter of a million. So it's a really big, you know, this is what you can do with animals. You can get a big, big set of figures that, you know, the animals that were fed his preparation as a food additive were much healthier, much less susceptible to illness. I think they grew quicker. Certainly that more of the feed, there was a better feed conversion from feed into protein. So, you know, they were more efficient in their use of their resources. Again, the same thing, they're just healthier animals. So, you know, it ties back into this idea of a universal panacea. It seems to be, you know, an additive that just makes us able to, I guess, use our ingredients that we live off, our food, use them more effectively.
So you actually took some of this stuff and you were hooked up to some equipment in the film. What would you described it a little bit in the film, but can you sort of recap that and what your experience was taking this stuff?
Yeah, look, I mean, I've taken it a few times. People have said that they've had, you know, ecstatic experiences, and, you know, I never got anything like that from it, to be honest. I mean, the first time I took it, and that's in the film when I had it in that little mountain hut at Peter's, I definitely felt slightly trippy. I definitely felt some kind of, you know, psychotropic effect, I'd say. But it was pretty mild. And, you know, I've taken in my life a number of interesting substances, comparable, not really. I don't know personally on that kind of level. Yeah, I felt something, but I imagine I'd also feel something if I took a small amount of strychnine or arsenic. You know, it's difficult to measure exactly what it was. I felt different, but is that a good or a bad thing? I don't know. When I took the stuff that, you know, I'm on camera and I've got an EEG cap on my head and we're measuring my brainwave patterns. Again, you know, I'd much prefer to do that. You know, if I was going to do that experiment, I'd do it with a bunch of people and get a series of readings. You can never really tell if it's just one person. I didn't feel personally any effects from taking Ethereum Gold, which is this, you know, it seems to be a form of almost that occurs naturally, which they put into pill form. I didn't specifically feel, you know, more in tune with myself or creative or whatever at that point. But, you know, I was in the middle of a pretty stressful journey traveling around America, trying to track down alchemists and pin them down to, you know, to be interviewed. So it's difficult. You know, there's too many variables on my personal life at that point to see if there was a tangible effect on my sort of well-being. But there did seem to be results, you know, on the EEG that were pretty interesting, in so much as my alpha brainwave patterns spiked after taking it quite dramatically to almost double the size. And that's the brainwave rhythm that is that becomes more prevalent in healers, in when you're meditating, in that kind of calm and an effective thought mode. But, you know, I wouldn't say it was a particularly scientific experiment we did. It's just, you know, I knocked some tablets back and, you know, measured my brain.
How long did it take before the effects started to register on the machine?
See, we did it over a couple of days.
Oh, okay.
So first time, you know, I just got off the plane. I was tired, and actually I was falling asleep when I was doing it, because you've got to sit really still, because any movement, you know, totally screws up the electromagnetic sensors. Yeah. So actually I was kind of falling asleep and I was getting a false reading because I was getting delta waves in there as well. And it was just, so we tried it the next day. The next day I had to, you know, there was a rush because I had to fly off to the airport as well, catch a plane. So it was all a little bit, you know, there's these variables that you need to control for. So it wasn't absolutely clear, you know, what was causing these differences, but there was the one effect that seemed to be going through that was that I had increased alpha on the second day compared to my baseline, which was the first day, and quite considerable. What I didn't get, it wasn't, you know, that I took this thing and suddenly I got a spike in my alpha on the first day, because on that first day, you know, I started falling asleep. So it's not a great experiment, but there is the result that I got from it was the result that I was expecting from the literature, which is kind of interesting. So, you know, it kind of confirmed the theory up to a point.
So I'm going to diverge a little bit here, and I'm not 100%
sure. Let's talk about cars or something.
I'm not 100% sure I'm going to leave this in the interview. So,
okay.
But I've got to ask this from my own research, and you probably don't know this about Keith and I, but we are – I'm involved, and I head a group that deals with traumatic hauntings. We're very involved in the paranormal and ghosts and that sort of thing, and know lots of psychic mediums, and Keith and I have both sort of developed our own abilities. Some of the things that are described, especially by Don Nance – in his interviews that I found on YouTube, are very, very similar to the beginning stages of, I don't like using this term, but the beginning stages of what we would call a spiritual awakening. He describes that as a byproduct of taking Ormus. I don't like calling it a spiritual awakening, because if you say, I'm more spiritually adept than some other person, it...
There's an element of, you know,
superior
the ladder. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it's just a different state of awareness. It's a different state of perception. So I wonder, and you've taken this stuff and I haven't yet, if Ormus could potentially take somebody who doesn't have that level of awareness and puts them to a higher level of awareness, we are intensely curious as to what is going to happen when somebody who already has their own level of awareness then ingests this material, what that's going to do to them. Does it take them to the next level, or how do you have any inclination as to what that would be like?
I'm not sure if this bit was caught earlier on before the tape ran out or whatever, but you know, it's the idea that, you know, we are, and if you go down to the atomic level, did we catch this bit? You know, the idea of I'll tell you anyway. If you go down to the atomic level, you know, there's no specific particular block particle that we're made of. We are energy, essentially. We're energy and probability.
Right.
If there's something that acts, that seems to act in that realm, again, you know, it's taking a series of sort of leaps of faith, really. Well, if this happens, then this could happen, then this could happen. If there's something that acts in that realm, if Ormus is this material that seems to be atomic, a substance that we know as gold or say, but is in a different atomic structure. Somehow its vibrational qualities are different. And for some reason, in this sort of vibrational state, it seems to have very profound effects on organisms. That atomic structure is different. That it's waveforms. It's the way that it works in that realm is somehow different. I don't necessarily see why you can't infer from that if you have more of that stuff in your system, you aren't connecting slightly better with the general connectivity around you, that sense of being able to feel your environment, being more intuitive, you know, being connected to whether it's the zero point of dark energy or being more likely to sort of vibrate at levels that your colleagues are vibrating at. I think there's theories there that are workable. And I think it's possible that Ormus might actually work in that kind of way. I don't see that as spiritual enlightenment. Excuse me. I don't see that as spiritual enlightenment. I see that as... okay, this is an analogy, but this is a story that, you know, I sometimes tell about this. I used to do quite a lot of work with horses. And I was training a horse up, and I noticed that when I was in the ring, it was going into a trot and a canter before I was giving the command. You know, as I was thinking about this state of that I want to transition into, you know, it was getting there slightly before I was doing it. Now, I don't know if it was reading incredibly subtle cues that I was giving, or if it was reading an energetic state around me. If, you know, horses who eat a lot more vegetables than we do, and possibly they have more Ormus in them or whatever, you know, they can read very, very subtle signs, very, very subtle emotional or cues from humans. So there's, you know, I don't see it as such a profoundly crazy thing to say that there's ways of communicating that aren't verbal. And perhaps, you know, taking something like this accesses that level of vision, whatever it is, in a way that, you know, just eating burgers and chips is going to perhaps hold you back a bit. So I do think there's a possibility, given what we know, or what we think we know about this stuff, that it does enhance your sort of vibrational, God, I don't like using these words because totally unscientific and I don't know really what I'm saying, but it's a way of explaining it. It does enhance your vibrational well-being in a way that you can actually get a bit more information out of the world around you.
Well,
any sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think Don was, if I'm not mistaken, Don Nance is the one that said this. He said, basically, and I guess he was just gathering this from what he thought. He said, basically, what it does is it lets all your cells in your body communicate with each other. He kind of put it like that. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. It does.
I mean, that's what I like. I mean, I think that's when you can, yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. There's various sort of theories about, you know, microtubule theories about how cells communicate with each other. As you drop a chemical into your system, it sort of figured out your body communicates through the neurons quicker than the possibility of just that electrochemical pulse going from your head to your toe. Somehow it gets there quicker than pure chemistry that we know about should get there. So there's some kind of communication through your body, superconductive element or electromagnetic communication that happens, which isn't just the biochemical transmission of nerve impulses and chemicals and hormones and stuff throughout your body. So yeah, perhaps this stuff ties into that, you know, the energy that energy healers work with. You know, at its most simple, it makes your aura stronger, I guess. I have no scientific backing for this. I'm saying this purely sort of from an intuitive basis. I think it's possible probably to conduct, you know, to create and conduct experiments that could measure this kind of stuff. And that's really where I'd love to see this story go, you know, where we can convince a few establishment scientists to actually put a little bit of money into it and create decent experiments that you can get statistically relevant results from and measurable results. I do, you know, but people do these kind of things. People do these sort of tests and still, you know, the world tends to want to ignore them.
Right.
I mean, like you probably know about Hal Puthoff and his remote viewing experiments that were done, what is it, in the early 80s or something, in the 80s?
Yeah, Ed Dames. Is that who you're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he worked with, it was quite a big United States governmental organization.
The CIA.
And I think
yeah.
It's CIA, that was it. They started trying to train up some of their operatives with remote viewing.
Yes, I saw some stuff on that as well. You're right.
And they had really, really profound, interesting, positive results. I mean, extraordinary results.
Yeah, one of our team members is actually trained in Ed Dames' remote viewing techniques, and it's extraordinary.
I mean, it basically knocks all our theories of reality into a cocked hat. You know, the fact that, you know, you can see what someone else is seeing at exactly the time they're seeing it in a completely different location.
So,
it doesn't make any sense according to what we believe or what mainstream science believes to be the way that the universe works.
At the risk of kicking you back into the rabbit hole, I'm going to throw something else on your radar. There are so many parallels between what we're talking about and the effects of this substance and just the general topic. It's in your best interest, I think, if you haven't done this already, to look into what's called holographic theory. Have you heard of this?
Oh, yeah, before? Yeah, absolutely. Talbot wrote that book, didn't he?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that book. I mean, that book definitely, that theory that this existence that we see in front of us isn't really the actual existence, isn't the reality. This is an outfolding of metadata that is held in a different kind of plane of existence. Makes so much sense to me about why there's this sort of cross-pollination of data from different realms. It's a great theory, and it really makes a lot of intuitive sense to me.
Going to say something about it when you were talking about the horse earlier. Well, the horse is sensing it, you know, before you even realizing it.
Yeah,
yourself.
I mean, with that story, I didn't finish, but what I ended up doing with that horse is I could command him to enter trots and canters, you know, without saying anything. And I would literally, I would be there, you know, he was on a lunging line, and I would keep my body as absolutely still as possible. And all I would do was raise my energy level inside me, you know, sort of energize myself a little bit. And he'd go into a trot and then sort of energize myself into, you know, feeling his cantering, and he'd go into a canter. I don't know if he was seeing me, you know, get a little bit more tense, whatever, but you know, my inference from that is that there's an energetic state that I created that he felt. So, you know, what is that? What is, where is that communication of energy traveling through?
Right.
And, yeah, I think, you know, the holographic theory of the universe is a pretty interesting theory, actually. Yeah. And there's some recent evidence. I didn't understand the mathematics of it at all. I tweeted something that I read about it recently, but there's a mathematical physical evidence for the fact that actually, you know, that theory is correct. So
it's very compelling. It's very, very compelling. The evidence, literally the evidence that's out there is suggests that this may be, that model is true. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it makes a lot more sense to me than the mechanistic. Oh, excuse me. I think we'll go over that a little bit.
Yep.
It makes a lot more sense to me than the very basic mechanistic model that we have, that we are just essentially machines built from our DNA, and that there is no consciousness and nothing more to life than just. I mean, there's deep philosophical problems with that idea of, you know, consciousness is just an apparent illusion from the way the machine works. It's like, well, right. that's just you're getting out of explaining consciousness. What is consciousness? You just wrote that sentence. Are you saying that you don't have any consciousness, or you're just
right?
Yeah. So, you know, if we can begin to sort of believe that the mechanistic model that we have sort of all been brought up on, very simple atomic machines that just behave in a certain way because of evolutionary, just because of, you know, evolution allows things to get a bit more complicated, and we now think that we're alive, but we're not really. Yeah, it's just, if we can get away from that, then actually, you know, the holographic theory is, I think, a very profound and very compelling way of looking at the universe.
So to get back to the Ormus a little bit, I don't know if this is of interest to you, but I'm certainly willing to keep you guys in the loop. We're going to experiment with this the substance with our mediums, and we want to see if there's a marked, and we do a lot of measurement and comparisons of readings and documentation. We're going to see if there's a marked improvement over our standard performance level when taking this stuff.
What I mean, do you measure with kind of like card tests and stuff like that, seeing if people can see what's on the other side of a card? And
they're a little more real world scenario. So what we do in most of our investigations, part of the procedure, is that we get photos of a place or a person that we're going to be investigating, and we send these photos out to different mediums that we work with, and then they don't know anything about the story for the client. They just get the photos, and then they give us a reading based off of those photos, and we match the reading they give us with the story in our investigation, so that we get sort of a blind mediumistic reading. And anything that they pick up on their reading that significantly overlaps with the story, we consider a hit.
Wow, that's an interesting way of doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we consider that a hit. And the more hits you get, the more accurate you are. So we could theoretically sort of empirically measure if you get more hits if you're on this stuff, if you're more accurate.
That's fascinating, yeah. I mean, it's that thing of empirical measurement that I think is so important. I mean, it's you can get very tied into it.
Yes. And it can be subjective.
Exactly, and you can end up looking for the results, or designing experiments that will give you results that you're looking for. So you've got to be very careful about all of that. Yes. But I think the starting place is, you know, to get empirical data. You know, takes anything out of the realm of, well, pseudoscience, really, isn't it? That's fascinating. Yeah, I'd love to see what your results are on that one. That's great. Have you decided which Ormus product you're going to take?
I'm actually going to. I may. experiment with Don Nance's White Dove. I want to talk to him a little bit about that first. That's apparently a more potent substance, but I've got the stuff sitting on my desk right now. Dead sea salt that apparently has, it appears to be, from what I gather, the right type of salt and caustic soda, and we're going to experiment with making this stuff ourselves.
Ah, there you go. Excellent. So have you got yourself a pH meter?
Yep. We're uniquely, as the universe has it, synchronistically, we have some very corresponding skill sets that makes this very easy for us. So we're going to be able to play with it without much effort or expense on our side.
Well, that's very exciting. I mean, I think it's I was chatting to a guy just who I met recently here who, I mean, if you want, I would do it. By all means, do it. I think there's better ormuses and there's worse ormuses. And I think the kind of the amount of ormus you get out of sea salt and, you know, that sort of home cook wet method, I think is actually quite low. I think it works well with plants, but I think in terms of psychoactive, intense bodily experiences, I think some of the sort of, my guess is the old Vedic concoctions that someone like Don Nance might be able to mock up, I think would have possibly more profound effects.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I want to talk to Don Nance. He's been taking this stuff for a while, and I want to, he doesn't have our frame of reference, but I want to correlate his experiences with the standard wet method he taught us versus his experience with the, there was the Essene gave him some special ormus that was made specifically for him. And that
he was
had
like an M3. Yeah.
M3. So that had different properties even than the White Dove process that Don Nance developed. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're all cooked up from different base ingredients, from what I understand. Some are cooked up straight from M3, I think, is made from you use metal and gold in it, and also other products. And a lot of the other ones are mineral preparations using plants and things as a sort of base ingredient. I don't really know. That's my understanding of it. So they're all made in very different methods. And I think, you know, the Essene, there's a number of people who call, well, there's the Essene who's, I think he's now, we now know who he is, but I can't remember his name. There's the idea that they are tapping into past lives and have this knowledge from, you know, artificers from ancient Egyptian times. So, you know, I mean, for me, it's quite, I've taken a leap of faith on certain of these, on some of these aspects of ormus. So I'm quite happy to explore, you know, the possibility that there is some kind of time continuum thing of people getting information from past lives. And, you know, it possibly does leave me open to being gullible. But, you know, what you're proposing here is, you know, a scientific experiment with measurable results. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. It's great to take it into that kind of realm. Yeah, good luck with that. Keep us posted.
Yeah, we're excited to see how that pans out too. So, to sort of recap, how do people get a hold of your film? And you've got some additional commentary and interviews that aren't part of the standard film package. How do they get a hold of this? How do they watch it? And what's the benefit of these extra interviews?
So the film is called All the Gold You Can Eat. And I've set up a website, which is quite simply allthegoldyoucaneat.com. So go on there, and there's a bit of information about ormus, and there's and you can actually watch the film right online, right there. It was quite frustrating for me. I had to create an entertaining film. I had to keep it down to an hour and make it an entertaining journey. Because my purpose of making this film is to open up the story to a much wider audience than A, the people that know about almost already, and B, the kind of people that already circulate around that world that, you know, are perhaps only one or let's say 2 degrees of separation out of there. So it's a very easy accessible film for mainstream participants. But because of that, I had to lose a lot of the really sort of interesting data, a lot of the interesting information. And I found that quite frustrating. So what I decided to do is release these little series of, you know, kind of the full interviews, or let's say the full edited interviews with each of the contributors, to hear what they were actually saying. So what I've done is created this internet portal where you can watch the film. You can also watch, you know, these 6 or 7 much longer videos. And I think the films and, you know, the videos in total, the little cast interviews, they add up to about 3.5, maybe 4 hours of footage. Some are more interesting than others, but it's really, really good information. Anybody who sort of finds this fascinating and wants to explore it further, they've all, you know, people all said that, you know, the movie's great, really good fun to watch, really interesting, great way in. But it's the information in those cast interviews that it's that's the really fascinating stuff. So yeah. All accessible on the website, allthegoldyoucaneat.com. And I've also started writing a blog. It's not, you know, I mean, it's early days. There's only a few entries there. But, you know, what I'm interested in is questioning the dogma of science, you know, why people are so attached to their belief structures so as not to be open to new suggestions. And, I mean, you know, the idea is to use this, you know, use alchemy, use this supposedly completely redundant and ridiculous theory, which I personally seem to have some information on to show that it isn't as crazy as people think it is, to use that as a way to sort of wedge the door open, or wedge people's minds open a little bit, can really confront them. So the blog is called, it's on the same website, it's allthegoldyoucaneat.com/blog. And you can find some of my more strange mind thinkings in there.
So, and I actually watched the interviews, and well, most of them, and the original documentary in that you originally cut. And I have to say, I have to chime in, that I find especially the interview you titled "The Sage," which is David Wolf, I think, that was especially interesting, and I like to hear what he had to say.
He's a very erudite, very interesting guy. Definitely, he's done a lot of his own research. He's very secretive about his methods, but you know he's done some good research, and he uses plant-based research as well, which, you know, means there's something tangible there.
Right.
You know, so
he also sells, and he has his own website where he sells monoatomic gold in solution. Just search David Wolf. Health food, and you'll find his website. The other interview I found really interesting was the one you titled the Metallurgist, which was Arthur.
Yeah, Arthur Ziegler. Yeah, I wish that I could. I had one day with him. We were just driving through. I didn't actually know about him. Barry Carter put me in touch. Picked up the phone, phoned him up, told him I was coming through. Arthur is, God, he's a delightful human being. He was so sweet, really open. We only got a day with him. I would love to go and film more with him. I mean, he was really doing some interesting stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, he's actually doing science, in my opinion. And it's exactly. Noteworthy. The other one was The Collector, the guy with the walnuts. That wasn't as enlightening, but he's doing some interesting stuff, and I thought that was well worth it. You could make your own documentary. You could make your own movie based off of Don Nance, the alchemist, in that interview. Clearly, that was well worth just the price of admission right there to get that extra footage with. I definitely think the interview with the alchemist is absolutely, man, it's worth 10 times the price of the admission to see him and his work.
He's such an absolutely beautiful guy, isn't he? I mean, people see the film and fall in love with Don. True. I mean, I consider him a really close friend. You know, I don't see him anymore. I have very little contact with him. But I love Don. His openness, his honesty. I just think he's an awesome geezer. And he comes across so beautifully on film, doesn't he?
He really, really does.
Yeah, he really does, man. He made the film, in my opinion. A lot.
There's no doubt that, I mean, you know, probably 30% of the film is devoted to him. He makes the film in terms of his character, his, you know, his openness, but also the simple fact of the matter that he teaches me how to make gold. You know,
right.
That's kind of what the film's about. So, you know, at every level, I owe Don this film, you know.
Yeah. His honesty and the fact that if he doesn't know something, he simply put it out there and said, look, I don't know. This is what I think. Yeah. I love that approach. That's beautiful. And that's the only way you can really be honest in subjects like this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, he's a very groovy guy. And, you know, anybody who asked me about getting into Warmus, you know, where would they go? I would point them in the direction of Don, but also Arthur Ziegler. You know, he's got a separate website, which he kind of keeps separate, you know, because he does his stuff with the industrialists and the farmers. But there's also, I think it's called Liquid Chi. I think it's liquidchi.com. He makes Warmus products, M-State products for human consumption too.
Oh, I did not know that. I'm going to check into that.
Yeah, I point you in the direction of those two producers, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to put all that in the show notes for sure. And for anybody who is interested in, again, as a recap, in making your own Warmus, Don Nance's methods are documented through one of his students in a book called Warmus Modern Day Alchemy, A Primer to Warmus Collection Processes, reference edition.
So you realize she's the woman that's in the film. That's
I didn't know that. That's her.
Yeah, her and Laszlo. She's the one that sort of put that book together.
Oh man, I could kiss her for taking the time to sit down and document that.
Yeah, no, it's a good work that she did. Really, it's great someone's done it.
So. Anyone who's interested in ordering Don Nance's product, he actually does make it for sale at a very, in my opinion, reasonable price compared to some of the other resources I found. You can get various M-State products or monoatomic gold Warmus products through his website, oceanalchemy.com. He's also got contact information on his website, though we should probably mention he seems to be a rather reclusive and private fellow, and it would be best if folks didn't bother him unless they absolutely had to. But his products are for sale.
Yeah. He's poor as a church mouse, really. He heals people. He spends his life making this stuff to heal people. And most people are so poor, you know, when they come to him, you know, they've been fucked over by their by the medical establishment. They don't have insurance. You know, he lives off donations. So he's a really, really modest guy. I'm saying that because, you know, if you send him a message, you know, about, you know, what's wrong with you and you need some sort of specific healing, you know, I think he's got a heart that's what he looks out for. But, right. You know, his products are a lot cheaper than most because he doesn't do it to make money. He does it to allow him to heal people. So I guess, you know, what I'm saying is, you know, help him out too. Don't hassle him. He's very reclusive. But if you do, you know, it's kind of down to you to give him what you think his work for you is worth.
Right. I completely agree with that. So we're going to put links to all of this information in the show notes. It's going to be available on YouTube and Spreaker and through our website and all the standard channels. I really, really tremendously want to thank you, Joe, for your time, and especially with your patience because of some of our technical difficulties, but we'll edit all this stuff together and make it seamless.
Make me sound normal.
Yeah. Did a great job, man. We really, you're very charismatic when it comes to speaking and communicating, and that shows through in the film beautifully, and I can't wait to see what else you do with the subject.
Awesome. Well, look, it's been a real pleasure chatting to you guys. Honestly, It's a subject very dear to my heart. I thought I was going to sort of be able to move away and make another film and do something totally different once I'd got this film out there. But I'm still fascinated by this stuff.
Kind of hooks it you is good, a, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? You know, it's. I mean, it really is fascinating, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it to people. And the work that you guys are doing is fascinating too. There's crossover there. I'm convinced about it. If you believe already, there's something interesting going on that isn't just this mechanistic reality, then, you know, it all ties in beautifully.
You got to follow your passions, man, and you're obviously passionate about this. So that's the only way you find happiness in life.
Exactly.
And in closing, we want to thank Joe again for his time and certainly his patience with some of our technical difficulties with this discussion. Hopefully the audience didn't notice the panic behind the scenes. But most importantly, I want to thank him for sharing his journey down the rabbit hole, as he put it. When he was intrigued with this topic, he decided to pick up a camera and share it with the rest of the world. We encourage everyone to check out his film and his blog and his website, www.allthegoldyoucaneat.com. The other websites we mentioned will be in the show notes for our website, higherconsciousnessradio.com, and in our YouTube archive notes.
By the way, we do have a new website, higherconsciousnessradio.com. You can check out everything we've got up there, and we always post links to everything in our links category. Lastly, if you or someone you know is someone we should talk to, someone we should help get the word out about, please feel free to contact us through our website, higherconsciousnessradio.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.